Hi, and welcome to the Conservation in HD podcast series. I'm Danielle Ross Winslow with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service branch of Human Dimensions. This podcast is part of our effort to put tools and resources into the hands of natural resource practitioners and is a collaboration with the National Conservation Training Center. On our last podcast, we spoke with Angelina Yost about the process of collaborating with Nuuvi tribes to design and build visitor centers for Desert National Wildlife Refuge Complex. As mentioned then, Jeremy Spoon and Richard Arnold helped to facilitate that collaboration. So we're very fortunate to have Jeremy Spoon and Richard Arnold here at NCTC and to have the opportunity to get them into the studio to discuss their work with us. Hi, Richard. Hi, Jeremy.
Howdy.
Hi. It's great to be here.
Great. I'll just have you go ahead and describe what it is that you do and what you try to achieve through the work that you do.
We actually try to bring tribes together, in seven different tribes of Southern Paiutes and Chemehuevi people that came together to align themselves to form the Nuuvi Working Group. And we work closely with Fish and Wildlife in trying to help co-steward and co-manage their land and resources out there. And our jobs are basically to help facilitate that dialogue with tribal people to make sure that we're getting good and useful information.
We view ourselves as translators or cultural brokers that help to have indigenous perspectives understood by Fish and Wildlife and to have Fish and Wildlife's perspectives understood by the indigenous ancestors to the lands in which Fish and Wildlife is managing today.
That was Richard, then Jeremy, so you know out there. And what was the role that you played in that desert complex collaboration?
We put together a working group of representatives from the seven tribes that consider Desert National Wildlife Refuge Complex to be part of their ancestral homelands. And through that working group, who are delegated by their tribes, we conducted collaborative ethnographic research where younger members from the tribes interviewed their elders in order to decide on what stories should be shared with the public. And while we did those sharing sessions, the agency gave us the freedom to have those sessions be internal for the tribes and trusted us that the information that we came out with would be robust and useful for the purposes that they had. And I think they were quite surprised with the amount of information and the quality by utilizing our methods.
And I think the information was also had to be brokered a bit in making sure that it was appropriate for what was being shared with the public, orientation to stories or restrictions that we may have. So we had to consider various cultural elements in which would be or what would be acceptable for the information to be shared.
And by sharing that information, you mean through the exhibits and...
I mean, anything and everything that goes on with the refuge, they've been very good at integrating the tribal voice and perspectives into everything that's going on out there. So you'll see the tribal presence in the exhibits. You'll have things through audio types of recordings that people can interface with that particular exhibit. There'll be things on the outside that shows how tribal people were involved, what the resources may mean. And then, moreover, there's opportunities where tribal people can come and share the stories firsthand with the public as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what is your background as far as where you're from and where you are now? We missed that in the intro.
Oh, okay. Well, my background is country boy. I'm from Pahrump, Nevada, and from over there, worked very closely on ethnographic projects since the 70s, for the last 40 years, actually, and working closely with many different tribes from throughout the California, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona for the Nuuvi people, and also with many other tribes, Western Shoshone and Owens Valley Paiute and Shoshone.
And I'm an applied environmental anthropologist, and I'm currently an associate professor at Portland State University and a research associate at the Mountain Institute. And I've been conducting research with indigenous peoples at protected areas for the last 20 years. And I've worked in Kenya, Tanzania, Nepal, Hawaii, and now the Great Basin, and more recently the Northwest.
So one of the products from this collaboration was a handbook that describes consultation for the seven tribes between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Park Service in the southern Nevada area. One of the things it says is, and I quote, "Without a doubt, these collective efforts made the collaboration stronger and built relationships that were based on honesty and true friendship. Together, these partners can keep the area strong and the cultural landscape alive through meaningful consultation and transparent communication." So that's a very strong and great outcome. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, what it was like when that didn't exist and then how you get to that outcome?
Sure. I think part of the evolution of this whole product and even the conversations that were going on between the tribes and the Fish and Wildlife Service actually did kind of a 180 in that it wasn't that Fish and Wildlife wasn't necessarily committed, but I think it was just a challenge trying to figure out who and how to talk to the tribes, you know, who would be culturally affiliated. Typically, many federal agencies will say the closest tribe, and they'll automatically just kind of hone in on that one without looking at there may be other tribes that have the ties. And I think with the Southern Paiutes, we were kind of scattered, so we had to be brought back together.
I also think in the past, the agencies didn't necessarily have a full picture of the cultural affiliation that tribes had to the lands that they manage. It's often common for Fish and Wildlife, Forest Service, Park Service to consult with the tribe that's closest to them or most accessible. And that might just be that they don't know that other tribes might have connections to this place. For example, a mountain can have many tribes connected to it as long as it's within the viewshed. And so it's very important, we found, to create a broad net of cultural affiliation that represents all the peoples that are connected to these landscapes rather than the ones that are just geographically close by. And by doing that, it's bringing back together something that was divided apart during the colonial time when tribes were divided out onto different reservations and the ancestral territories became completely fragmented. So by looking at cultural affiliation, it's a way of bringing back together these broader connections to these landscapes, which then can cross boundaries of Fish and Wildlife, Forest Service, Park Service, etc., and really create something that we could call restoration.
So one of the things I know you try to do through your work is ensure that, you know, traditional and local knowledge are incorporated into our decision-making and our conservation efforts. Can you describe, you know, what is traditional or local ecological knowledge and why that's important?
First, I think that the different types of knowledge that, you know, they've been labeled as whatever they are, I think that tribal people look at it from our vantage point and through our cultural lens, and that it's the things that are ingrained in us and through, as we say, out west, I mean, it's since the beginning of time or when the world was new. And so for tribal people, this has always been, always has been, and always will be our homelands. And we're always gravitating back to that. Everything that we do is rooted in those areas. So unlike other people or other populations, they can always move away and be more transient, whereas we have to stay in that area because that's where we're from. We need to use and protect and interact with the resources that are out there. I think that's really key. The other is that, quite honestly, with the knowledge, it's still alive and well. Many times people think it's something of the past, or we as Indian people are something of the past, and we're not. And so we also recognize that it may not be as vibrant as it once was. So now we're faced with sometimes the intergenerational challenges through other distractions. It could be through people working with their little iPhones and iPads, whatever they do with those things. And then in contrast to I think, with what we do with in trying to talk to people, and that was always part of our culture, is you have that verbal interaction all the time. And now people are too distracted. But we're bringing people back, and we have different events, I think, that it has helped kind of bridge some of those gaps.
The idea of taking knowledge and segmenting it into parts is definitely something that Western folks do. And, you know, as an academic, there's a whole subfield where I work with folks that study traditional ecological knowledge. And it's kind of information that's drawn out about the relationship between indigenous folks and the environment. From indigenous perspective, you wouldn't necessarily just focus on something called ecological. And that idea that knowledge somehow is compartmentalized doesn't necessarily fit. So I guess for our purposes, and as Richard pointed out, I'd say we'd use the term indigenous knowledge, and we'd also accept that it's changing and hybridized with other types and ways of knowing. Also, this dichotomy between traditional and modern can be problematic sometimes, because every word also has to have an opposite, right? So if we have traditional knowledge, that must mean that it's the opposite of what you need to be doing today in the modern world. Well, then that makes it kind of hard to be indigenous and doing things in modernity, right? Indigenous peoples have been populating the Americas for thousands of years, and over that time, knowledge is learned incrementally about how to adapt and live in different environments. That environment was also changing while folks were adapting, and so we have very adaptive, we'll call it almost a complex adaptive knowledge that's been incrementally gathered over years. And that information can be quite helpful to environmental conservation efforts as well as restoration. And much of it is focused on how to maintain a robust ecology, as Western science would put it, with heterogeneous species assemblages of different age groups. Or we could look at it in a personified way, a family with relatives of multiple ages and backgrounds. One of the main differences, though, is that indigenous folks, by and large, especially Nuuvi, consider interaction with the environment to be vital for environmental health. Well, at times, that's the opposite of what a park has been set up to do, where they put boundaries around it and do not allow people in it. So there's a slight paradox here where the general public might not understand that humans can be beneficial for the environment rather than always being detrimental. And I feel that the indigenous knowledge can be the bridge to that and show that actually the United States is an anthropogenic landscape in itself, and that this idea of nature and wilderness without humans is actually something we're constructing in our own minds.
So you've been involved for a long time in this particular collaboration and with others. Can you boil down for us some of the key ingredients or what you've learned that makes this type of collaboration successful?
Yes, I think there's several. First, I think there's the openness, the commitment. We as tribal people, I mean, we constantly tell people, you know, you need to speak from the heart. It needs to be truly what you feel, and having sure that you're making sure that you're not only focused on what you want, but you're sincere in what you want. We say oftentimes that when people are talking, you know, we believe that, you know, you're only giving so many breaths for your life. And if you waste those breaths and you end up just talking and it's meaningless, then you're going to need those breaths sometimes. And you would have wished that you would have saved them. Secondly, that rapport that needs to be built is integral, because without that, it makes it very difficult. And we don't know if it's genuine. We don't know where people want to take the conversation, the relationship, or even a project for that matter. And so it's very important that you have that ability to, you know, sit down at the table and let's talk and let's be honest and genuine. With some of the folks that would come to talk to some of the tribal people, and I remember being in a session where there was a federal person that had responded back to a tribal person and said, well, let me tell you honestly about that. And then the tribal people said, what, you're not being honest with me? And they said, well, yeah, but it was the words and the selection. And so sometimes you have to remember the audience in which you're talking and making sure that the information is clear and the transparency, making sure that people are really showing and talking about everything. You know, let's answer the questions. Let's bring the information out there. You know, and let's not try to sugarcoat everything. We need to be honest. And I think sometimes that's a challenge, because sometimes people don't know how much to share or if it's going to offend somebody. And I think just when people are more genuine, you're able to have probably a better communication and a better understanding. The leadership and the participation is key, not only from the tribal side, but federal side as well. And so, for example, on the federal side, oftentimes you may get the head of a refuge or whoever it is, some leadership position that will come in. They typically introduce or kick off a meeting and say, okay, nice seeing you all. We're getting ready to go. I have to go. I've got something, you know, really important to do. And it's like, well, so we're not important. And then that's part of that commitment, I think, of making sure that people are there, because everybody is coming there because we want to hear what people have to say. And we're hoping that it's going to be something that's going to be useful for all of us. And that's why, you know, we hope that we come together to have those kinds of dialogues and communication. The other thing I think that is a big challenge is the changeover oftentimes, where you'll see in leadership, federal agencies, people get transferred or go on detail or just move. you know, and so we see a constant change. So that developing part of that institutional memory to make sure that people are not only on board, but they know what's happened in the past, because typically is what happens as soon as a new person comes in, you have to brief them, and it's almost like starting over again. So that's why we've tried to develop some documents that are good handbooks and resources for people, and then that way you can use that for subsequent administrations that come in to work and interface with the tribes. The more we can do to bring in tribal people to have a voice, to sit down and be integrated into programs, into the management, the restoration, the understanding, the adaptation, you know, we can do all of that as well. I mean, sometimes people think that Indian people were just something of the past, or that we lived that way and that we can't change. We're human beings just like anybody else, and so we have that ability to adapt, change, and we have a longer standing knowledge and background to the land and the resources. So I think it's very, very important that we be part of that. You know, tribal people, our first thing we're going to say, we need to get that land back. Okay, so, but if we can't get that land back, and if that's part of the refuge, some of the benefits are that, you know, the refuge does things that oftentimes is in concert with the with tribal thinking, and that protecting and preserving the resources and the land, we want to be part of that as well. Sometimes we may have diverging points of view on how we look at doing that, but it's still having a meeting of the minds or an understanding.
So to add to some of the key ingredients that Richard shared, I'd also like to mention that having a third-party facilitator can be helpful at starting and maintaining these types of collaborations. It allows the federal agencies and the tribes to both speak to a third party rather than to each other if by chance there was adversarial issues or just differences in opinion. And by having a third party there who has facilitation experience, it allows those opinions to be molded together, grouped together, in order for it to create a collaborative framework rather than something that's more adversarial.
Especially where you might be starting out where you don't have any relationship, or you do have relationships that, based on past history, aren't on the best terms, right?
Absolutely. And it's difficult at times, and I feel for federal agency employees having the time and resources to be able to make those relationships. And so a third-party person can help actually bring that together for everyone.
You know, and one other thought, too, is that with that third party, tribal people and agency people can really focus on the conversation itself, whereas a third person can have not only have the communication for stimulating the conversation, but they can also then be recording the notes, writing down the notes, or keeping key elements to bring it back so we can have a useful product in the end.
Mm-hmm. And that's been key in our collaboration, because not all groups, the culture of different groups, make decisions in the moment, right? And a lot of our meetings are set up, well, we all sat at the table and that's what we decided.
And I think the other part of that is also tribal people need to synthesize the information, oftentimes making sure that it's being, not only being processed, but just we may need to talk about it amongst ourselves, and then we'll come back and kind of bring back what our thoughts or suggestions are. And so things may not be necessarily immediate, like here's question and answer kind of thing, you know, or a counterpoint kind of a situation. It's really, we're thinking about it because we're considering everything. I mean, you're not only talking about the resource, but how that resource fits into the rest of the landscape or the environment.
And the way that we define that in a simple way is we call it little C and big C consultation. Big C consultation is the mandated consultation by federal policies, National Historic Preservation Act, National Environmental Protection Act, NAGPRA, etc. Little C consultation is the rapport building and the relationships necessary to have a collaboration like we're talking about. Big C consultation can often just be check the box, very, very minimal. It's really open to interpretation, even though the U.S. government is mandated to consult in a government-to-government way with Native American nations. The way in which that unfolds is very diverse. So we feel that the relationship building is the key ingredient that allows the Big C consultation to be effective, and it can create so many more opportunities and futures for the area than just doing what's the bare minimum. And 100% investment from all the stakeholders involved. So 100% investment from the Fish and Wildlife, 100% investment from all the tribes. And that's the way that it has to work. If it feels to the tribes that the agency is not putting all their efforts behind what they're engaging them with, they are reciprocally not going to engage them with that same level of respect and engagement.
As we wrap up here, do either of you want to share an example or maybe a common challenge that you run into with this type of collaboration and what you've learned about dealing with that?
One of the challenges that we run into is that we have a turnover, for example, in some of the staff that work for Fish and Wildlife or that are on the tribal councils or are within the working groups that we create. And as Richard mentioned earlier, it's fundamental that we have institutional memory set up so that we don't feel like we're always starting over again and that we can keep moving forward. One of the big, outcomes that has really helped us with this is the interpretation, because interpretation is material and it is fixed. So we've done, with Fish and Wildlife, we've worked on 4 different visitor experiences of the Desert National Wildlife Refuge Complex. And those visitor experiences have recast those areas as both places of people and nature, and that they are also part of the indigenous homelands of Nuuvi and also Nua or Western Shoshone. And that's evidenced in having that on the entrance signs as something so simple but yet so important to what we're doing. So by maintaining the institutional memory and having the collaboration be something bigger than just the people at the table at one time, it allows us to move forward and keep building and building and building into the future.
Yes, and one other thing I would think is that a challenge is finding the right fit. So you have, while you can have all the regulations and policies down on paper and they say what you're supposed to do, and you can send out all the clear messages that you want to, whether or not you have the right personality. Because oftentimes those policies and things are driven by, you know, budgets, timing, politics, and personalities. And so you can have one person that's very committed and they want to go above and beyond and do the most that they can. You can have somebody who's a minimalist and say, no, we're only going to just do this much. That's all it says. We'll just send them a letter. If they come, okay. If they don't, they don't. And so you have to kind of go that extra mile, reaching out to people, showing that you're genuine. And it really gets back fundamentally to what I said in the beginning about, you know, speaking and doing things from the heart and making sure that it's going to occur that way to make sure that it's going to be progressive in nature.
Mm-hmm. So do either of you have any key resources that you'd want to share, either about your work and some of these best practices or anything, even say someone's looking to start a collaboration like this that they might want to go to or do before they even launch into something?
Well, one resource that we can share with everyone is actually brought to you from the World Conservation Union, or the IUCN. We were asked by them to submit a case study for their Cultural and Spiritual Values of Protected Area Task Force that shares how we created the collaboration and what are the key ingredients for governance and management of what they call protected and conserved areas. And you can find that on the IUCN website by putting in Nuuvi Ancestral Territory. And you'll see our case study come up and all of our contact information. Additionally, there's been 2 different refuge update publications that shared a little bit about our collaboration that will be included with the podcast.
Well, and I think that there's a couple of other documents and resources. First, just for the record, that the Nuuvi is spelled Nuuvi. And so you can kind of Google that, and many things will pop up. And some of the reports that we've done for Fish and Wildlife, I think that would be another opportunity in which people can look at and trying to find some information, foundational information that we used and that we wrote about how to engage tribes and what to do. The third part would be, I'm always free with other people's information other than my own, so to contact Jeremy Spoon, and he has his email address, and I don't, so that's another resource.
So my website, jeremyspoon.com, lists much about our projects, as well as a list of academic publications where we share aspects of our methodology, and my email at jspoon@pdx.edu.
So I wanted to really thank you so much for being with us in the studio today while you've been here at NCTC. Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks, Richard.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Great. And we will share those resources in the description of the podcast. And thank you all for listening. I hope it gave you some insights into this topic. And we have several additional podcasts. You can subscribe through iTunes or by searching for NCTC Podcasts. If you have any ideas for other podcasts or questions for the Human Dimensions branch, you can email us at human_dimensions@fws.gov. Thanks again.